Thank you very much. So I'm going to tell you about another mechanism to form the thick disk eventually. So after radial migration and maybe, you know, feedback or heating for high redshift galaxies, I'm going to go back to looking at what satellites do to the disk. So I'm very interested. So this is in collaboration with my collaborators, who are Eddie Squillen for this work, Piero Madao and Lars Sernquist. So what we're doing here is using simulations, not cosmological simulations, but simulations in isolation, so the disk in isolation, in a halo, in a live halo, and bombarding the disk with substructures extracted from a cosmological simulation. So the substructures are alive, the disk is alive, the halo is also alive, and the substructures are extracted from the Via Láctea 2. Now, they have random orbits in this simulation. They don't have the right orbits of the Via Láctea 2. So what I'm interested is in looking at, actually, the reaction of the disk to these perturbations. So and looking at to the collective modes as a reaction of the disk. And I will show you why it is important for estimating the heating of the disk. So I'm interested, actually, the question is how the orbital energy of a satellite is deposited in the vertical action of the stars in the disk. So the points I'm going through quickly are, I want to show you that if you look at the direct heating of stars, which are, you know, on resonance in their orbital periods in the disk, with the satellite, with the perturbation of the satellite, the rotational field of the satellite, I can show you direct heating doesn't help you very much. So it doesn't give you the right estimate of the heating of a stellar disk. And this has been used in the past by Todd Stryker. They used the direct heating, you know, tried to estimate with dynamical friction how much was the heating. And you know, that kind of work is very limited because it doesn't account for the collective modes, which I'm going to tell you today. So we need simulations to look into the collective modes because disks, self-gravitating disks, they carry, they support, for example, bending waves when they're excited from satellites, and also other features that I'm going to tell you today. So first of all, let me show you the simulations that we have. So these are the substructures. So here, there is the disk, but it's not displayed. These are the substructures extracted from cosmological simulations. So you can see this substructure here is almost as massive as Sagittarius, actually a little bit more than Sagittarius. So it's a quite massive substructure. And this is the disk. So the disk, when it's punched by the substructures, generates collective modes, so for example, bending waves. What I'm looking at now is to show you, you know, what we can learn from a substructure, a satellite punching the disk, and how much is going to be the heating, and how much could be interesting for, you know, for the formation of the thick disk. So they found very interesting about the thick disk is that we need something, a mechanism which is very efficient in heating the inner parts of the disk, and that's not so trivial. And I will show you why. So actually, this is the disk. Look at, you know, look at John. You can see kind of bending waves propagating to the disk. If you look at it face on, you see kind of rings. And I have to say that this work has been also done previously from Purcell and James Bullock. And I really appreciate their work because it shows, you know, again, this kind of patterns that are rings in the face on disk. But I'm going now further, you know, deeper in this analysis and showing you what I think is going to happen during the punching of the satellite. So let me also tell you that the satellites with lower mass do not do anything to the disk. The only satellite that has really any importance in this disk is the one as big as Sagittarius. So direct heating, why I think the direct heating, you know, actually this is, should be already known, maybe not many people are aware of this. The direct heating doesn't help you much if you want to estimate the heating of the disk, because, okay, it tells you basically you compute the mean change in the vertical energy per unit mass of the disk star during the passage of the satellite. That's because the stars near, you know, the mid-plane, they oscillate vertically, they have a certain vertical frequency. And then when the satellites pass through, they're accelerated from the mid-plane. And so you can use, actually, the impulse approximation. You can think to use the impulse approximation, actually, to estimate how much is the energy deposited during the passage of the satellite. So first, you can compute the vertical frequency of the stars, because that's what you need. And it's basically the second derivative of the potential. So I'm using an Nernquist profile. That's the advantage. In this kind of simulations, I can control almost everything. For the Nernquist potential, I can compute, you know, analytically even the vertical frequency of the halo. And then you can compute, for example, I used here the Spitzer formula for the exchange in energy that, you know, it's deposited, it's exchanged the stars that fills, you know, the passage of the perturbation from the satellite. So the variation in energy of the Z component will depend for, you know, for a satellite of a mass m, will depend on the mass, on the scale height of the disk, on the vertical frequency of the stars in the disk, the impact parameter, and these are kind of parameters that, you know, this one is the most interesting one. I called it alpha. Sometimes in literature in Spitzer it's called beta, but so it's basically, it tells you basically, you know, the ratio between the characteristic passage time of the satellite divided by the orbital period of the satellite. And so it's a combination of the relative velocity of the satellite, the vertical frequency, and the impact parameter. Now, what can we learn from the impulse approximation? Well, the impulse approximation, I've done this work in the past. Actually, it tells you, you know, it's a kind of a resonance, but it's a broad resonance. So if you want to see the kick to the velocity that the stars get for a flyby encounter, you know, and you want to see as they change for as the alpha parameter change, you can see that the maximum exchange in energy happens when alpha is equal to 1. So if, you know, for lower alpha or higher alpha, basically you don't have much of exchange. And so because this is the case where basically you know, the orbital frequency of your satellite is basically in resonance with the vertical frequency of the stars. Now, if you look at how many stars do satisfy these conditions, there are not very many. And the reason is that, well, you can even look at analytically, so the stars that gain energy are, because that, you know, it is a broad resonance, the ones for alpha equal 1, so only the ones who are not very far away from the impact parameter. So there are not many, many stars. So this idea that by, yeah, this idea that by basically by heating up, you know, using the impulse approximation when a satellite passes through and you have heating up the entire disk, is basically an approximation that it cannot be true. That's why you need to look at the collective modes for a disk, because it would say that it's like to say that in, you know, the vertical frequency tends to be zero. Then immediately you heat up all stars. So by direct heating, you do not heat up all the stars of the disk. You can only consider the heating for the stars close to the impact parameter. Also, you know, if you have a very high velocity for the satellite, well, alpha tends to be zero, so there's not much resonance there. Or low velocity, alpha tends to be infinite. That's the case where there's not much deposit of energy, because it's the case where there is the adiabatic response of the disk, so there's no heating happening there. Indeed, you can. That's what I did next. So guided from these simple estimates from the Spitzer paper, you can look at into the, you know, in the simulations. That's what I've done, and I've computed the vertical frequency to see where is the power, you know, for in my simulations. And interesting, this is m equal 1, this is m equal 2. So there's a lot of power with very low frequency. So I'm exciting modes with very, very low frequency. Very slow features are basically developing here. And so, so then, okay, then one could think that, as I showed you, we form bending waves. Instead of gravitating disks, they support the development of bending waves. Then one could think that maybe the bending waves are the way to heat up the disk. Well, if you use a simple dispersion relation from Toomer, going back to Toomer, we can basically substitute now the vertical frequency of the halo, the surface density for an exponential disk. I'm using here the velocity dispersion in plane and the wave number. So you can put it dimensionless, the same equation from Toomer, you can put it dimensionless, and you can get out which is the minimum wavelength. Yes, that the minimum wavelength, so which is the wavelength actually that stabilizes your disk. So the minimum, which are the, say, these, the bending waves which are surviving in the disk. Because these are the interesting ones that eventually could heat it up. Well, these are the ones who are very, very large. So the wavelength is changing by the radius. So we're finding basically that the long wavelength modes are the ones dominating in this galaxy. Now, if you have long waves, wavelengths in bending waves, these are eventually dumped in the other parts of the disk. So you can only heat up by bending weights the other parts of the disk. Eventually you can form maybe their flares or whatever, but it's not heating up the inner parts of the disk. That's what we need if we want to explain if there is a thick disk in the inner parts. So the bending waves are not interesting for, because they are not dumped basically internally. The ones who are surviving, the stable ones, are basically dumped in the other parts. And indeed, so basically the bending waves are not probably very interesting for the heating of the inner parts. Let me tell you which is the idea behind now, what I'm proposing here, is that actually if you have, if you think about a satellite passing through the disk, well, I showed you, and also Purcell showed this with James, that you form rings. But what is interesting is that you have to think about that the satellite will be like a perturbation on the Z component. So there are rings in phase on disk, but there are also kind of a wobbles which will be formed. Because it's like if you have, so you can explain it like to have rings distortions that comes on the Z component and rings on phase on, which are basically all tilted on small little amounts. So, for example, if you consider a perturbation in a ring, and if you go back to the physics of the works, you have the physics to explain maybe what's going on here. So, if you take, you know, if you take a perturbation of this for n equal one on the Z component, the ring pattern will be basically retrograde. And this is exactly what's going on in my simulations. And the reason is that you can compute the pattern speed of these kind of rings or wobbles that they are forming. And so this is basically the circular frequency. And then this is you know, the vertical frequency of the halo, which is dominant it's always dominant. So the difference between the two gives you the pattern speed of these kind of rings, of these features. And it's going to be retrograde. So these are retrograde wobbles that are basically not in phase all the time. So what happens here is that there is a heating mechanism, which is due to a kind of, we call it like phase wrapping. So it's like of, you know, having not in phase, continuous rings not in phase, and it's a kind of phase mixing. And this heats up the disk in the inner parts because of the nature of the retrograde patterns. And of course, it's retrograde because these oscillations is basically, so the perturbation is, so the disk is oscillating, you know, faster on the vertical frequency than on the, you know, than the orbital frequency, than on the circular frequency. And they are changing by radius. So just to give you an example as a sketch, if you have an extended perturbation here, which punching the disk, well, you can see that, you know, you have a kind of a wobble that should be, and this is a kind of, you know, rings that are basically not in phase and forming this kind of phase wrapping. So the conclusion, vertical, maybe I'm proposing here another mechanism to form a thick disk. I showed you that probably the dice heating is not very important, so it's important to look at in collective effect, relative modes, bending waves, I don't think are any important in this case, but the vertical disturbance that oscillates up and down so fast will wrap around because of these properties of the galaxies. And that may be quite interesting also because we know that there are local vertical oscillations in the local neighborhood measured from other surveys. Maybe in place of thinking that there are vertical oscillations happening there, it could be that the wobbles could explain what we see locally, basically, in SIGWE or other surveys. Stop here. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Questions on this talk specifically? All very clear?
So, did you do a completely self-consistent simulation where the perturber was, you know, had back reaction in it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So, because, you know, from, you would expect locally for this, you know, to figure out the back reaction on the perturber from just what's happening locally in the stars. And so if it went through fast enough, it wouldn't have any chance to wipe out these perturbations that you get from simple impulse approximation because the perturber's already gone. So I guess I'm confused about, you know, why there's this resonance condition under conditions of something going through faster than the orbital
speed. Because
the
stars basically, you know, never have the velocity. So basically, the perturber will never have power at the frequency of the stars, you know, that are oscillating in the disk. So you never get that condition verified. So they don't move at, you know, they move at velocities very different. And the relative velocity of the satellite, if you take something like Sagittarius, is going to be very fast. So it doesn't really help the impulse approximation.
How does this help you heat up the inner disk? I mean, I thought that was the main motivation of what you were saying. I don't see why this helps at all in the inner parts. You create a wave, you know, basically you pull up part of the disk, then the thing wraps around and starts wobbling, but that won't affect the inner regions more than anything, any other.
No, it does, because...
Wave. Why?
Well, because it's a retrograde pattern, and then, so it doesn't take long, actually, to saturate the velocity dispersion in the inner parts, and then, of course, it propagates, it will shear out. So as another prediction would be that if you have a later passage of a satellite...
Why does it help you heat up the inner parts, which I thought was your main motivation? How does it help you heat up the inner regions?
Well, because these patterns are retrograde in the inner part. They start in the inner parts, and then...
And why does that matter? I don't get it.
That doesn't matter, because they are in the inner parts, and so they are not basically... they're shearing out in the other parts only later on. So initially, they heat up in the inner parts of the disk.
One final question on this talk, and meanwhile, can I ask the four other speakers to come up front?
Are the subhalos live in these simulations, or are they...
Yeah, well,
we
initially did it with a static potential, but then I put an alive halo because I wasn't sure if the bending waves, you know, would have been dumped.
Not Milky Way halo, but the subhalos themselves. Are they live, or are they particles that
are
hosting?
They are alive. They are alive as well.
Have you looked at the streams that those guys generate?
No, I have streams, but I haven't looked into that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, Devin, if you want to look into, it would be good.
Let's thank Elena again, and don't run out. So now we have the general discussion session. Judy, you were a speaker. Come on up here. So what I asked each of the speakers is to send me their two key questions to the audience, and you see them projected here. Maybe a bit small, but anyway, that's what you sent me. But there were still some other questions from the audience to the speakers in the chemodynamical talk, so we can take them up first if you like, or whatever. Up to you. Hans Walter Riggs will start the floor. Yeah.
I guess a question to Ralph, because it had come up yesterday. So let me try to regurgitate the argument you gave that's kind of the smoking gun for radial migration. And it is that in the Milky Way and other nearby galaxies, the ISM has very little spread in metallicity and a modest gradient. Yet when you look after 3 giga years of age, there's this enormous metallicity spread among stars, and so that can only have come from very wide-ranging transport of stars in radius. Is that what you think would be the single best argument?
Yesterday it came, I think Julio, somebody said, you know, somebody muggled about where's the smoking gun for radial migration, and I guess that's not only the qualitative, but also it has to be dramatic, otherwise you can't get this right. So I think that's...
Well, I guess it also shows that it can be migration of gas, because if you just migrated the gas before it formed stars, you would still have a one-to-one relation at each radius.
I was telling this to Hans Walter, but another thing that would be interesting for migration is a actually to figure out exactly how many arms there are in the galaxy. I don't know if it's very easy, but if you know exactly the rotation curve, you know how much is the contribution of the disk with respect to the contribution of the dark matter, because actually by stability of disks, you can know the number of arms. And for migration, I don't know if Ralph agrees on that, but there are two aspects. One is the amplitude of the arms, and I do agree that our submaximal galaxy has lower amplitude arms, but has several. So number of arms and amplitude. When you reduce the number of arms, that means you make more massive disk in the inner parts, then you increase the amplitude of the arms and you reduce the number of arms. So to me, the efficiency of, you know, number of arms versus arms and amplitude hasn't been very clarified. And if we would know exactly how much is, you know, with this rotation curve, and if it's submaximal or not, we can know exactly how many, you know, we can estimate by this stability of disks, and we can know exactly how many arms there are, and the amplitude, too.
Well, you're singing my song, almost. better not. But this is exactly what I tried to say. We need to know those impact factors, and actually, it's not only those two. If you look into what migration is really, the change, the speed of change of your amplitudes is very important. So this would be factor three. Factor four would be the winding angle of your arms, and you can go on like that. We have no quantification on that, so the task would be not only to ask Hans Walter how many arms we see, but also to go into a simulation of, I don't know, how many thousand or at least hundreds of different spiral patterns to get the impact of each different coefficient sorted out. So that when we have the observations, we can say, this is what we see and this is what we would expect.
I hate to derail that. I mean, I think that's fascinating. I think you pinpointed exactly a really fundamental question there. But I was going to ask a slightly different question to Jonathan, okay. Maybe a little extreme. But you were talking about how your model was, you could think of it as sort of a resurrection of ELS on the disk scale. But in the simulations you've analyzed, have you pushed it back farther than 8-9 giga years? I mean, are you actually, maybe, do you actually see star formation in inflowing gas stuff that's going to have even higher velocity dispersion that really could be sort of ELS-like or a subcomponent of ELS-like stellar halo?
So that's a really good question. The short answer is no. I haven't looked at the halo stuff enough to really see. I can tell you that at very early times, you're still dominated by star for, you know, certainly by mass, you're dominated by star formation at the bottom of your potential well. And during the major merger epoch, you put a lot of energy into all those stars, and some of them do get scattered into the halo. I have not looked at, you know, if there's actual, as the primordial gas is collapsing, if you're actually getting pockets of star formation. That's going to be very dependent upon the star formation prescription, and yeah. So it's interesting, but no, I haven't. No looking yet.
And your reaction to that? Or swap teams? Oh, sorry.
Hi. Just now Joe made a comment on you just migrate the gas but not the star, it's not enough. So I wonder why. Is it also because we are constrained by the AVR? Or I'm wondering why migrating the gas is not enough.
I just meant that if you migrate the gas and then, you know, and you assume that the ISM is then well mixed at each radius, it forms then stars of a given metallicity at that age, and so you would have a one-to-one tight correlation between age and metallicity, even if the gas was, you know, came from somewhere else. And, you know, maybe the metallicity would decrease again at some point, but, you know, it would still be one-to-one. You wouldn't have this huge dispersion.
I guess I'll, Ralph, you mentioned comparing the Segway metallicity distribution to models, and you also mentioned the Geneva-Copenhagen survey, and then you touted that this Bayesian inference of stellar parameters is critical to comparing to models, which I agree with. But in terms of disagreement, were you saying that there was a disagreement between Segway and Geneva-Copenhagen?
Absolutely.
I don't think that the Bayesian inference is going to make a big difference. I mean, there's a lot of things that are outside the scope of statistical analysis that could be different between those two, like, you know, line lists. That's just one example.
I fully agree on that point, partially. What?
Well, the GCS, of course, you know
that. Yes, of course. Okay, although one has to fix Strömgren photometry is approximately as precise as any spectroscopy. So one should also keep that in mind. So the error that you have on the Strömgren is of order 0.07 for the GCS. So it's not an error problem on the photometric side that we have. I mean, you can measure that in the calibrations. The point that I would make is that if you have one pipeline that analyzes all your surveys, you already exclude a major struggle of different analysis for different pipelines, so that gives rise to the first category of systematics. You do have systematics by the different spectral resolution, there I agree, and there you have different spectral ranges to incomplete models, and there you have no other way than having vast cross-calibration sets of stars that are common to both surveys if you do this job. But again, if you have stars that are common to both surveys, you do far easier if you have one pipeline that deals with both surveys at the same time.
Well, as someone who is co-guilty of the Copenhagen-Geneva survey, or Geneva-Copenhagen survey, I want to point out that indeed the modality values in the GCS are photometric, but there was a parallel investigation by a subset of the same people, which was called, published 10 years earlier in the name of Edwardson et al. And the point of that was exactly to verify the modality errors, including the detailed chemical composition, which is a separate discussion. So the errors in the modality distribution was determined already in 93 by high resolution spectroscopy, and the discrepancy between the dispersion around the age modality relation relative to the observational errors has maintained. And your own paper from the Geneva ESO Geneva survey, or the Gaia ESO survey, there's a recent one about the age modality relation with VLT UVS spectra, shows exactly the same. It's basically the same diagram with the same selection effects that we had in the Edwardson et al. 93. So, well, I would maintain it's the same thing, except you quantified it and we didn't. So the bottom line is that the dispersion around the age modality relation has stayed constant, and the observational errors have been decreased strongly over the past 35 years. And that's the smoking gun that Hans Walter was looking for, in my view. And you can reshuffle the stars in the age direction because of all the horrors of age determinations that we have discussed today. But the bottom line is that for a given age, in most part of the life of the lifetime of the disk, the dispersion is real and it's not observational.
Okay. One quick comment on this is that GCS is not measuring in situ, you know, things very, very far away from the disk of the galaxies. I don't think it's a question of metallicity errors in the Geneva-Copenhagen survey. You have to have a kinematic model that tells you where those stars are going to go to be able to compare to something like Segway. And so there are other channels to say that you can have that could cause differences between the samples. I did want to pivot a little bit to the metal poor stars, because you have some questions about bright metal poor stars. And I think in this line, one question I'd like to ask, or you, or feedback, is if you want to do this, it'd be really great to design controlled experiments. So if you can find basically boxes on the HR diagram where you can find a bunch of metal poor stars that are like at a fixed gravity or a fixed luminosity or something like that, you can then think about constructing tests like astroseismic tests or abundance tests. And I guess one question, which is kind of related to Anna's work, is your way of selecting these metal poor stars biasing you in their chemistry? And is there a way that you can deal with that?
So one concern, obviously, would be if we were biased against carbon-enhanced stars, because carbon goes into the molecules which cause all that absorption. So one reason we're not biased towards that feature is that because these stars are so far up on the red giant branch, typically, that their carbon has been processed into nitrogen. And just they, even a star which had a carbon enhancement when it was formed would not appear to have a carbon enhancement when we observe it at the tip of the red giant branch. So I don't think we're biased against carbon-enhanced stars, except for a carbon-enhanced star that was FeNH of -2 and then a carbon to iron of +2. We would be biased against stars like that, but they're not very common.
So you had this statement that...
Can I ask a question, actually? The gold standard in this game is not the stars at -2 or -3. Hundreds of those are known now, although not in the bulge. The gold standard is at -4 or -5. How are you going to get down there and without spending enormous amounts of time in this big sample?
Well, the nice thing is that these stars are apparently bright, and so you can get a high-resolution, high-signal-to-noise spectrum in just a few minutes with a big telescope. So we don't need to spend 20 or 30 minutes on individual stars. So it could be that as we examine this further, we'll say that, well, maybe these stars are bright. Perhaps the ones that are extremely metal poor have Galax excesses, for example. That could be something to try out in the HALO. I mean, there's obviously a lot of things to do. I would not argue that this selection is in its final form. This is very much a work in progress. I mean, if you go back in history, the calcium HNK selections didn't work perfectly when they first started either. I mean, there has been 30 years of effort into getting those surveys to where they are today.
So you asserted that of the two or three stars you had, that there's a 70% chance that they're born at redshift greater than 10. So that statement must be strongly model dependent in some way.
So it's definitely true that they are ancient, in that halos do form from the inside out, and at constant metallicity, something which is tightly bound to the galaxy is very old. So qualitatively they are ancient, but the exact numeric value is model dependent.
That would also be a question from my side, because who tells me that this is not pockets of low metallicity material that just starts forming stars at redshift 5, 4, or even later, just was so far away from the centers of action that essentially nothing happened to it?
So that actually is what happens for metal poor stars which are in the HALO. So yes, they are did form in a lower sigma peak somewhat later, but because they formed in a halo which had very little star formation, they have very iron poor abundances. But because these things are in the very center of the halo, they got there very early on. The idea really is that the inner 2 kiloparsecs of the galaxy, at least in dark matter, accreted 75% of its mass by redshift 3. So most of what's there got there quite long ago.
Well, the problem is baryons are not dark matter, so the effects of dynamic friction will be more dominant for them.
But stars are like dark matter.
No, the stars hang to the baryons, which are in the center of the mass distribution, so they will experience far more dynamic friction than the dark matter part that is falling in. So they will pierce deeper. Hans Walter is in disagreement.
If you think those stars got in as part of satellites, then you
could
think
more
from stars
as
particles, right? Like dark matter
particles. Yes. No, I don't want to exclude this scenario at all. All I'm saying is I have doubts about that it must be like that.
So, you know, Judy showed this plot of this heroic amount of data that had these still enormous error bars at 100 kiloparsecs. So how are we ever going to get halo mass, you know, the halo mass of the Milky Way at 200 kiloparsecs to 20%?
Part of the problem is that I have to go through each of these papers and try to understand what they're using for R, i.e., are these galactocentric distances? Are these heliocentric distances? Are they galactocentric with a spherical or an oblate spheroid? I don't think that's going to do enough to make them coincide, but it might help. And I only made that figure yesterday actually, or the day before I came here, I made that figure. So, but it is, as published, a fair comparison of what exists in the literature with our results.
Final question.
Yeah, so Ralph, you put some skin in the game here with your, you know, this is my smoking gun, and I'm going to ask you guys to put some in the game too. So what's the smoking gun of phase wrapping, and what's the smoking gun of upside down formation? Like, give us something that we can sink our teeth into.
10 seconds.
So I guess something that I'm interested in as the smoking gun is, at least in this upside down model, at some point as the gas is collapsing, you do reach some intrinsic temperature floor. So, you know, the molecular clouds today do have some intrinsic velocity dispersion. And so you could imagine that at this transition point, that there are, you know, maybe there's a signature in the actions of stars born after this, the disk has fully settled, and as it's settling, all the stars that form after the disk has fully settled should undergo, you know, kind of this traditional heating process, and perhaps they all look, have some signature to them that the ones slightly older, and this is not. Yeah, pretty much, and it really, what's nice is you may be able to make large bins here. You could say, you know, hey, four things that are 4 or 5 giga years younger and things that are older, and kind of look at the orbital characteristics of those.
Well, the big question, however, is how do I disentangle from spin-forming satellites that also heat up certain ages?
So there what's nice is because the age velocity relationship is so smooth, you know, if you're trying to bombard the disk to heat it, you would expect some discontinuity where the satellite impacts. So because you're going to preferentially heat up the youngest, coldest stars at the moment of impact. So you would see, you know, if at 5 giga years ago there was a large impact that really heated up the disk, in your age velocity relationship, you would say 5 giga years ago, you would see this discontinuity. And
final smoking gun.
Okay, no, I think it would be very important to have these measurements of the, if there are distinct components in kinematics and in chemistry. I would say that, in my opinion, the process I'm proposing would give, again, I haven't looked at, yes, in details, but yet in details, but I think it would go on the direction to reproduce maybe a continuum in kinematics because of the nature of the phase, you know, the phase mixing. And if there is a distinct component in chemistry and in kinematics, that means that you need to have like a passage of a satellite in the early time. And then eventually, what Sagittarius does now are creating wobbles. These wobbles, I believe they are there, but they are not, they are hitting maybe locally the disk. The smoking gun would be also give predictions, for example, for local heating that must still happen now. That's something I think I would give as a prediction of this model now. And for a previous passage, what would be interesting is to understand if, you know, I don't know the orbit of Sagittarius, I think Stephen knows better than me, I was asking him today, a satellite in the early phases could have produced maybe, you know, for similar mechanism in the early times, but then having multiple perturbations make more complicated the system, I mean, the picture. But having, you know, knowing if you can reproduce the data with Apogee, that, you know, if you can reproduce this continuum in the kinematics, then would be, you know, kind of, for example, accepting some of these models. And if there are two distinct components in kinematics, I see very, very difficult, even for your model, actually, to reproduce it.
Okay, lots of stuff to discuss over drinks. Let's thank all the speakers for this lively discussion.
And the reception is beginning in the courtyard, followed by the dinner.